Hello everyone, Marco Werman here. It has not been an easy 2020 for any of us. Somehow we at The World have managed to keep cranking out a news show about how the entire planet has been challenged by and coping with this historic disease. But behind every broadcast and all the reporting and production that go into it, there's an awareness that you are also trying to do your best to keep your chins up and of those next to you through this adversity. As I record this, we need 450 more people to donate to meet our goal of 1,000 donors by the end of this year. When you make a gift of $100 or more, you will not only receive an exclusive invite to a virtual party with me and the team, I will also personally thank you on a podcast episode. Donate today to The World to support our coverage tomorrow. Right now, go to theworld.org/give. And from everybody here at The World, thank you.
Waiting for a vaccine? If you're an undocumented Venezuelan in Colombia, the president says you won't get one.
Duque says it would be like inviting a stampede from the Venezuelan side of the border.
I'm Carol Hills, and in the U.S., President-elect Biden promises to end the so-called Muslim ban, raising cautious hopes for would-be immigrants.
We're hopeful. But we've had hope before.
We had hope before. The same thing. Our hopes just died. Yeah.
And paying for climate change. Why it's easier to pay for solar panels than a seawall.
It is easier to finance things that generate cash.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're listening to The World. We start today in Latin America. The coronavirus vaccine is starting to be rolled out there. Two nurses in Mexico and Chile were the first to get their shots last week. But in Colombia, the president says one group will be barred from being immunized, undocumented immigrants from Venezuela. The World's Jorge Valencia has that story.
Since early in his administration, Colombian President Iván Duque has been clear about his position on Venezuela. Here he is in an interview with PBS shortly after he was sworn in 2 years ago.
There's a dictatorship that has destructed all the economy, that has annihilated liberties, that has destroyed independent powers, and people are just running.
People are out, just running is barely an exaggeration. More than 5 million people have fled poverty and violence in Venezuela. Their most common destination is Colombia, where the government estimates some 2 million Venezuelans have relocated in the last 4 years. President Duque and many others consider this one of the worst humanitarian crises South America has ever seen.
So I have decided that we're not going to close the border. We have to give them support.
And he did. Duque's administration has authorized 700,000 people who have crossed the border to legally live and work in Colombia. And last year, Duque signed the law granting citizenship to all children born in Colombia of Venezuelan parents. So it was a surprise to many when Duque spoke out just before Christmas about undocumented migrants during the pandemic.
Presidente, los venezolanos podrían tener acceso a la vacunación?
One of the morning hosts on Bogotá's Blue Radio asked Duque whether Venezuelans would have access to the coronavirus vaccine.
Nosotros tenemos en este momento la priorización siempre serán los ciudadanos colombianos.
Our priority will always be Colombian citizens, Duque said. The Colombian government will begin receiving vaccines in February, and as of right now, the country will be short doses for 15 million people. It's estimated 1 million Venezuelans are living in the country without proper documentation. And Duque says that they are the ones who won't be getting a vaccine. Duque says it would be like inviting a stampede from the Venezuelan side of the border. Dione Cruz, head of the Colombian Public Health Association, says she was shocked to hear Duque's comments. Cruz says the Public Health Association is calling for everyone to receive a vaccine. It doesn't make any sense not to give a vaccine to any group that can be a vector to the general population, Cruz says. The pandemic doesn't discriminate based on nationality, she adds. And if denying preventative care to a group doesn't make sense public health-wise, it is also unethical, she adds.
Obviamente, por su estatus irregular,
undocumented migrants are a particularly vulnerable population, specifically because they're living in the country without papers, Cruz says. In general, they're more likely to live below the poverty line and in close quarters. Dr. Juan Viloria is a Venezuelan physician who lives in the Colombian city of Barranquilla. He heads the international advocacy group Coalition for Venezuela.
Yo no creo que vacunar a los irregulares vaya a generar una estampida, como
Viloria says he doesn't think giving a vaccine to undocumented migrants will invite a stampede the way President Duque says it would. He says the stampede already began years ago, but
nosotros en ningún momento tratamos de atacar o ponernos en contra del presidente Duque porque
But Viloria says he never criticizes President Duque because Duque is Venezuela's biggest international ally.
Yo pues entiendo de que es un gran reto para Colombia.
I understand it would be a major undertaking for Colombia to give vaccines to an additional 1 million people, Viloria says. He says he hopes the international community will help cover the undocumented migrants or that Duque's administration will reconsider.
Resulta mucho más rentable pagar una vacuna de un
After all, Viloria says, it's more affordable to give someone a shot than to give them a bed in a hospital. For the world, I'm Jorge Valencia.
Early on in the pandemic, South Korea was seen as a huge success story in fighting the spread of the coronavirus. Its effective testing, contact tracing, and quarantine systems helped keep the infection rate relatively low and avoid an all-out lockdown in the country. But over the past month, those measures seem to have stopped working. New cases and deaths in South Korea have nearly doubled in that time. Here's Korean health official Kwon Jong-wook speaking through an interpreter about the surge at a briefing today.
In Korea, we are seeing an upward trend of the daily tally, and it's once again in its four-digit number. And today we had 40 additional fatalities, which is the highest daily death toll since the first outbreak here in South Korea.
Reporter Jason Strother is in Seoul. So, Jason, it seems like the systems South Korea put in place to control the virus in its early stages are just not keeping up with how the virus is spreading now. Why is that?
Well, Carol, the first wave of the pandemic here happened in the city of Daegu. It's a much smaller city than Seoul. And the epicenter was in a church. So, I mean, there was a logbook of members, let alone the ability for contact tracers to locate all of those people who had potentially been exposed. The way it has spread now in the capital area, which is home to about 25 million people, it hasn't been able to keep up with the way the virus is spreading.
So how is it spreading now?
Well, there are still cluster infections. There are church outbreaks here in Seoul. There have been several hundred inmates and personnel at a prison that have fallen ill. But it is largely community spread, about a quarter of all these new infections. And yeah, it's around 1,000 every day now, have been taking place in households, according to health officials. This makes it much harder to trace when there's not, you know, an epicenter, a core outbreak happening like in previous waves.
Is there pressure on the Korean government to take even bigger steps, like more of a real lockdown?
The South Korean government is kind of dangling the threat of raising the health alert system to its highest level. We're at the second highest right now. But I think authorities are afraid to do that because of the economic as well as political repercussions. If we do move to level three, and frankly, we should have been at level three already just based on the standards of the health protocols here, it would really hurt many small businesses that are, you know, just barely holding on now as it is. So I think authorities really want to, you know, hope for the best and are just continuing to encourage people to limit their social endeavors, of course, practice social distancing, just in hopes that they won't have to take any more drastic actions.
What's the vibe there right now in Seoul? I mean, are people concerned? Are they being much more careful and cautious? What's it like?
Throughout the pandemic, Carol, people have been very vigilant here and have followed social distancing protocols. Mask wearing is not an issue, but it is hitting closer to home. The previous outbreaks, the first one in February happened in Daegu. It was generally isolated to that region. But now in Seoul, people know someone who has been infected. So it is seeming more real to Koreans. And just looking out on the streets, you know, over the, you know, the holiday, this past holiday weekend, people weren't going out as much as they normally would have. So I do think people are taking the government's request very seriously.
What about vaccines? I mean, I understand U.S. forces based in South Korea started getting vaccinated today, but the local Korean population has not started getting vaccination shots. When is that expected to happen?
The first vaccinations are slated to be administered in February, but officials are saying they might not have enough of the population vaccinated sometime until the fall, and that is not fast enough for many South Koreans.
Jason Strother in Seoul, South Korea. Thanks a lot, Jason.
Thanks a lot, Carol.
Russia announced this week that the coronavirus death toll there is more than three times higher than previously reported. The country's statistics agency says 186,000 people have died from COVID. That's the third highest number of deaths in the world, behind only the U.S. and Brazil. We're joined now by Irina Yakutenko. She's a Russian science writer based in Berlin, and she's the author of a new book about the pandemic, The Virus That Broke the Planet. Irina, were you surprised when these new numbers were announced?
No, actually, I'm not surprised. There were suspicions that these numbers are not real, and now they more or less reflect the reality, I think.
How do you explain the timing of this announcement? Why now for revealing these very updated and very different numbers?
As far as I understand, there is a delay in reporting the true numbers of deaths, because in Russia, you should make an autopsy. Only after that, you can write down the cause of the death. So it takes time, especially when we see this huge number of excess mortality and all the hospitals and morgues are packed up with corpses. So it takes time.
Do you think the Russian government was intentionally underplaying the number and underreporting the number?
There were rumors that they somehow play with numbers, not conceal them, not hide them, but to make these delays, not to reveal all the excess death numbers at once.
How are Russian hospitals coping with all the new cases? I mean, is there enough capacity?
A hard question, actually, because we don't know the real numbers. The same with the statistics. It's not good. So I think the hospitals are overwhelmed, but not as overwhelmed as they were in spring. But the other side of the problem is, I think we have problem with diagnosis. So from one hand, in Russia, we have a very good situation with tests, far better than in Europe. But if you have typical COVID symptoms, you cannot make this PCR test anymore. I think some people can do it in private hospitals, private clinics, private labs, but not all of them accept people with symptoms, and not all people have money to make this test privately. So I think in Russia, the real numbers are bigger.
Now, Russia has its own coronavirus vaccine, which has rolled out, the Sputnik vaccine. How is the rollout process going? I mean, who's on top of the priority list?
Medical workers, teachers, and social workers. So in many European countries and then the US, on the top of priority lists, there are elder people. So in Russia, that's not the case. Russia, of course, clinical trials for Sputnik V vaccine wasn't performed for elder people. Officially, it was announced that clinical trials for people older than 65 years old started only in the end of September or in the beginning of October.
So the Sputnik vaccine, right now, the priority is on healthcare workers.
Healthcare workers, teachers, and social workers. So they're in the priority list. But as far as I know, almost everyone in Moscow, for example, can go and have their shot.
Really? So it is accessible to the average Russian?
And again, as it's typical in Russia, so no one knows for sure. So officially it's not, but I have a lot of acquaintance, a lot of people in social media who came and made this shot. And so I think it's like a discrepancy between these two ideas, from the first that everyone in Moscow can go and have their shot, and the second situation that we have started vaccination several weeks ago and we haven't vaccinated enough people. But yes, I think there are problems with access to this vaccine. For example, in Moscow, I think there are enough vaccines. But in regions, I've heard numbers, there are like 200 vaccines for a small town, like 200 vaccines. So yeah, I think there are problems in supply.
Irina Yakutenko is a Russian science writer, and she's the author of a new book about the pandemic called The Virus That Broke the Planet. Irina, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming up, refugees in Turkey look to the incoming Biden administration for hope. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. People everywhere are thinking about what they'll take away from 2020 as we head into 2021. The leader of the World Health Organization is no exception.
Let me raise a toast to science. May we share its results, especially the vaccines, fairly and equitably in the year ahead, and together end this pandemic. Happy New Year.
Tedros Ghebreyesus and a team of public health experts gave their final press briefing of 2020 this week. It was a year that started with just a hint of awareness about an emerging new respiratory illness and ends with 1.7 million people around the world dead from the coronavirus. At their final briefing of 2020, health experts warned that for all its destruction, disruption, and death, the new coronavirus is not a worst-case scenario.
If there's one thing we need to take from this pandemic with all of the tragedy and loss, is that we need to get our act together. We need to get ready for something that may even be more severe in future.
That's Dr. Mike Ryan of the WHO. He said the coronavirus pandemic is a wake-up call that can teach us how to be ready for even more deadly viruses in the future.
We are learning now how to do things better, how to do science better, how to do logistics better, how to do training better, how to do governance better.
For WHO advisor David Heyman, learning those lessons has urgency because this coronavirus may be with us for a long time, an endemic and regular presence in parts of the world.
We have to learn to live with this and use the tools that we can in the best way possible.
There's one more thing the WHO reminded us of this week, the scientific victories that led to new vaccines in just months rather than years or decades. Here's Tedros Ghebreyesus again.
We learn something new every single day. Sometimes good, sometimes challenging, sometimes downright surprising, but all helpful.
And another story now of people looking for hope. President Trump's so-called Muslim ban has for years blocked entry to the U.S. for most immigrants and refugees from several Muslim-majority countries. President-elect Joe Biden has pledged to end that ban on day one. As Duri Bruskarin reports from Turkey, this promise has given some families reason for hope.
A baby sits on her mom's lap in front of a piano, eyes wide and excited. On the other side of the room is a tiny Christmas tree hung with ornaments and a homemade garland of dried orange slices. For a moment, it feels like home, and it almost could be. But until Sarah Bahirehi, who's a U.S. citizen, has the right to bring her husband and daughter into the United States, the holidays feel wrong. Her husband, Afshin, is a Christian refugee from Iran.
Part of being a refugee is like living in the short term. You're always hoping you'll be leaving soon. And so, yeah, decorating for Christmas, something like that, almost feels like an act of surrender in a way. Like you're saying, okay, we're here now.
By here, she means an apartment in the Turkish town of Nevşehir. The town sits in a dry, plain valley bordered by ancient caves carved into porous volcanic rock. It's beautiful, Sarah says. But it loses its sheen when you can't leave. In 2014, she came here as a temporary teacher for American families living in Turkey. Then she fell in love with Afshin, who was staying in Nevşehir too.
Our first date was 7 hours long in one cafe here. And despite being so different, it felt really easy. Like we clicked right away.
Afshin agrees.
Yeah, I fell in love with her because it was important for me to believe in God, believe in Christianity. I would say that as someone who's coming from a Muslim background, I paid a lot for that. In Iran, looking for someone who be strong and solid in whatever I believe, she should believe in that too.
After about a year of dating, Afshin learned that the UN's Refugee Resettlement Office had assigned him to be resettled in the United States. To him and Sarah, it was a sign.
We were kind of at that point, is this going someplace serious? Is it not?
It was. As Afshin went through the security interviews and background checks needed to immigrate to the United States, Sarah started thinking about where they'd land. Maybe Fargo, North Dakota, near her parents, or Minneapolis, where there were friends and more options for jobs. In December of 2016, they got engaged. But those plans came to a screeching halt after President Trump imposed the travel ban and slashed the number of refugees allowed into the U.S.
It goes completely against the entire purpose of the refugee system.
Manar Wahid is an attorney for the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union.
It goes against our values. It goes against the America that we are aspiring to be.
The ACLU is one of the organizations that filed class action lawsuits to challenge the Trump administration's travel bans.
It is an administration that has targeted Black and brown immigrants in particular to prevent them from coming to the United States, to make them fearful, uncomfortable, hidden, pushed into the shadows.
This year, Trump cut the number of refugees allowed to enter the U.S. to 15,000, less than a fifth of the quota set by the Obama administration in 2016. A lot of potential refugees are instead trying for other types of visas, like getting sponsored by a family member. Immigration lawyers say that can work, unless applicants are from one of the countries named in Trump's visa ban. Nigerian-American health workers in Houston trying to sponsor their elderly parents are told it's nearly impossible. Yemeni grandparents in New York apply in vain to get their adult children out of a war zone. And Somalian refugees in Des Moines have waited years for their husbands and kids to get cleared to enter the U.S. Wahid says even though Biden has vowed to reverse these policies, the changes will take time, perhaps years.
Making sure people who are already waiting, who have had their security checks, who have had their health checks, are being processed for admission, but also starting to rebuild the pipeline that they have destroyed.
For some people, a Biden administration means they will finally be able to file a visa application for their family with some hope that it will be accepted. For others with applications in progress, they're hoping years-long delays will finally be resolved.
Let me feed her.
She's hungry?
I think so. Okay.
Back in Turkey, Sarah and Afshin duck in and out of a Zoom call, swapping out baby duty. Their daughter, Esther, has big brown eyes and those chubby 7-month-old baby cheeks. They're making it work, but this wasn't the plan. And the pain of the past 4 years is undeniable.
All the Iranians, they have a stupid regime. We have a radical regime. We know that. But sadly, because of the stereotype of Americans has got that feel, it was really painful for us.
Afshin's refugee application was denied a year ago. He's now waiting to see if he qualifies for a waiver to enter the U.S. as Sarah's spouse. Just a few months back, he sat in a consular office for his interview and pleaded for his future.
Then I explained to him, I'm a father right now. My wife is American. My daughter is American citizen. I'm in limbo. I cannot provide for my family as a man of family. You're a man. The officer was a man. He was a nice guy. Could be a father too. He said, I'm so totally sorry. I really cannot do anything. This is not on me.
While 2021 may give Sarah and Afshin some hope, they're staying cautious. So are a lot of families with mixed immigration status.
We're hopeful, but we've had hope before.
We had hope before. That's what I'm saying. Our hopes just died.
Yeah, so we hold things loosely.
For now, they're waiting outside the U.S. because it's the only way to stay together. For the world, I'm Duri Buscarin in Istanbul.
Up next, an update on a border wall, but not the one you're thinking of. You're listening to The World.
Just a quick reminder from me, Marco Werman, and the World team. Over the past year, The World has brought you reporting on the most pressing issues of 2020 from all corners of the globe. The World is not going anywhere. We are determined more than ever to push through to keep bringing you the expansive global coverage you rely on, no matter what. We've been right there with you all year long. Now we're calling on you to be there for us. We're just 450 people away from reaching our goal of 1,000 donors. When you make a gift of $100, or if you possibly can, $1,000, you'll get to hear your name in our podcast credits. You'll also get an invite to a virtual party with all the incredible people who make this show possible. Help us keep the world accessible to everybody across the globe. Donate today before the year ends. Go to theworld.org/give. And from everybody here at The World, thank you.
Come with us today as we journey with a singer from Mexico to the U.S. and back again.
She could picture her homecoming show in her mind.
Maybe one or two songs, not being able to sing them because I'm going to be crying, you know?
The song that captured it all, coming up on The World. The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. China is building a wall, a steel barrier across its mountainous 1,200-mile border with Myanmar. China says it needs to construct this wall quickly to keep people infected with COVID-19 from slipping in across the border. Myanmar is indeed struggling to contain an outbreak, but Patrick Nguyen, the world's Southeast Asia correspondent, says there are other motives too. Patrick, tell us about this wall. What does it look like?
Well, unlike the Great Wall of China, which is built of stone and quite high, parts of this wall look like a chain link fence with razor wire on top. And then you have these other parts that are these thick steel walls, reinforced steel, with heavy spools of razor wire on top. And in some places, there appear to be high-tech cameras. The terrain there is really rugged, really mountainous. The wall is not complete. One report says they have about 400 miles completed so far, but it's hard to know exactly what's true because China is not saying much about the wall.
So what is the main purpose of this wall?
China's stated reason is keeping out COVID-19. I think that makes sense. Myanmar is really having a tough time with the virus. The hospitals have been neglected for decades, and they're really struggling to keep the death count down. It's up to 2,600 and rising. One official in Myanmar recently said the virus will probably spread around the country for years, as in multiple years, so that's really scary. And, you know, if infected people from Myanmar do try to sneak into China looking for work, that could spread the virus and ruin China's real success story at containing the virus.
I mean, along the border area, are COVID infection rates especially high?
Not especially high, but they're starting to creep up. When you jump across that border from China, you're likely in a place that's not controlled by the Myanmar government, but by one of several armed groups. And they're not just rebels sitting in the middle of the jungle. I mean, they have cities and streets and neon lights and casinos and everything. So it's a little bit of a Wild West vibe. And in those areas, we're seeing COVID-19 cases in the low dozens. Because China likes to keep warm ties with these groups, China has been stepping in and sending over help. And the biggest armed group on that border is called the United Hua State Army. They just posted a video notifying their people that China is going to send over nurses and build testing labs. That's a video in their native language, which is called Hua. And in that video, you see people in full biohazard suits putting swabs down people's throats right in that sort of dusty mountainous border area. And all of this is assisted by China.
COVID is the ostensible reason for this wall, but I'm guessing you think there are other reasons why this fence has been built.
Yeah, I think it's the ideal time to say, hey, we're going to build a giant fence because of COVID. But these plans unrolled suspiciously quickly, and I suspect they wanted to have this border fence there anyway. Some, not all, Carol, but some of the people going across that border are Chinese nationals trying to run from something. They may be running from police trouble, or they might be investors in some illegal trade like the drug trade. And until recently, before COVID, it was very easy for Chinese nationals to go across these not-so-secret river crossings and get into the Myanmar side of the border where those armed groups are ruling. But, you know, I think China said that just can't continue during the pandemic.
So this is interesting. China's building this fence and saying it's to keep people from entering China because of COVID. But you're suggesting China wants this fence to also keep Chinese from going across the border into Myanmar.
Yes. So after they have this fence, they will at least know everybody who is trying to cross. Some people they will stop because they are in police trouble. Some people they will let go over with sort of a wink, wink. And I say that because they're going over to do business or do investment with these armed groups on the other side of the border that rely on Chinese nationals, often participating in the black market to survive as their lifeblood. So with the fence, they might have cameras there that can see who's going over, and they can say, okay, well, if this guy was trying to slip over, we can step up police patrols to try and catch him.
Are there patrols along this border fence, or is it largely kind of cameras and kind of self-enforced?
There are already patrols. There's already a lot of heavy smuggling. And some Western media have focused on dissidents, saying that this wall is built to keep out Chinese dissidents. I don't agree with that. I think that if any political dissidents go over that border and they end up in the territory of one of these armed groups, the armed groups will give them right back to China. They're not going to harbor a dissident. They don't want to go against the Chinese Communist Party because it's not in their interest either.
The world's Southeast Asia correspondent, Patrick Nguyen, speaking to us from Bangkok. Thanks a lot, Patrick.
Thanks, Carol.
Something special happens when a musician talks to another musician about music, like when Ethiopian-American singer Meklit Hadaro interviewed her friend Diana Gameros for a music special we brought you recently. We're revisiting that conversation when the friends got into a particular song that traces Gameros' journey from Mexico to the United States and back. Here's Meklit Hadaro and Diana Gameros.
Can you tell me the story of the song and Juarez and what the process of composing it was like?
Sure. I remember I had just moved to San Francisco. I didn't have family there. And so I remember that I would reflect more about all that time that Juarez was in the news.
Maria Caridad's husband and two sons were kidnapped and executed.
Over 30 girls have gone missing in similar circumstances since 2009.
Because 2008, 2009 were some of the roughest years for Juarez.
This year alone, more than 500 people, or nearly 7 people a day, have been killed in Juarez.
Regarding the feminicides and the drug cartels.
That is increasingly run by drug cartels.
And one of the most dangerous in the world.
El aire tiene olor a que alguien murió.
Very vividly, I remember that I started thinking about the park that I used to play in Juarez. And I started remembering about the time when I was little and how you would see a lot of kids out on the streets. It was a song that a mother would sing, you know, come here, my little children. I'm going to tell you about the time when we could still dream. And so, in a way, in Juarez was a way for me to comfort myself, comfort the children in a city as violent and as dangerous as Ciudad Juarez.
Verán que la vida va bien.
Now, there's a reason Diana wrote that song in San Francisco and not in Juarez. And the reason begins with music.
I think I kind of always knew that I was going to do music.
Diana comes from a very musical family. Her grandmother taught her folk songs as a little girl. And her mother was a singer also.
She would walk me to a church that was giving guitar lessons for free.
She nurtured Diana's dreams of studying music.
Probably the guitar was bigger than I was, and so she was carrying it with no case.
Ultimately, it was that dream of studying music that led Diana to leave her home and come to the United States.
And so I tried my best to become an international student, you know, in the, you know, the legal way.
At first, she came on a tourist visa to stay with some family in Michigan for just a couple months.
I kind of went back and forth. I mean, I always had a visa and was able to travel freely.
But then when Diana applied for a student visa, she ran into trouble because her parents didn't earn enough money to prove that they could cover all her expenses.
You know, I kept failing and failing. And so I decided to stay and went through 4 years of college, completely as an undocumented student.
After college, those 4 years turned into 5, then 10.
Yeah, and then fast forward 15 years, I'm still here.
Just imagine that. Diana's hometown, Ciudad Juarez, is on the U.S.-Mexico border. She can walk right up to the bridge that connects El Paso, Texas, to Juarez, Mexico. She can walk right up to the fence that divides the two countries. But she knows that if she crosses that fence, she might never be able to cross back. And so she stayed and built her career here, starting at a little tamale parlor in San Francisco.
It used to be painted orange, and there was a sombrero on top of where I would play.
She found the gig as soon as she arrived in the city in 2008.
And I go on Craigslist, and then there's this ad in Spanish that read, "Solicitamos cantante."
Basically, the restaurant wanted a singer, someone who could do ballads and Mexican pop songs.
It almost, for me, it was like it had my name, like, Diana Gameros, we need you. Because it's everything that I could do. And then I come to the, what I think it's an interview, and the guy said, okay, so can you start today? Mira donde
Since that first gig, Diana has performed all around the U.S., sharing stages with folks like Joan Baez and the San Francisco Symphony. Wherever she went, Diana sang the song En Juarez and told audiences about her hometown as she remembered it. Yet she didn't dare to play it in the one place she wanted to most, in Ciudad Juarez. But when Diana and I sat together in the tamale parlor, she could picture her homecoming show in her mind.
I know that it's going to be outdoors. I can already feel the breeze. I'm probably going to, like, I'm already ready for maybe one or two songs, not being able to sing them because I'm going to be crying, you know?
A few months after that conversation, Diana finally received her green card. I can remember the party she threw to celebrate. There were about 30 of us there, spread out on blankets with tons of food and instruments. It almost felt like a wedding where the guest of honor drifts around to different groups of people to celebrate with each one of them. And then, after 16 years away, she finally went home in the fall of 2018. And now she's been back several times since. So what we want to do right now is talk through the trip to Juarez when you were there to perform. Mm. So maybe we can just start at the beginning when you arrived in Juarez.
My mom's home is very colorful. And there's kids. You know, I have my nephews that live next door, my brother. We are all into music, and so it's a very festive vibe, and everybody speaks very loudly. I've always found it so important that families stick together, you know, and it might be contradictory to the path I chose, which was leave my family, but maybe that's why I appreciate it now more, because I didn't have it. There was another beautiful thing that happened. I got to collaborate with young musicians that are part of the university, the Universidad Autónoma de Ciudad Juárez.
Juan Leal, I play drums.
Bass player.
Karina Torres, and I play the double bass.
A clarinetist.
Diana Jimenez, and I play the clarinet.
They would be the band for Diana's first show in Juárez.
To me, that was very meaningful because when I left Juárez, that music department didn't exist. You could not get a bachelor's in music. But at the same time, it was challenging because, you know, I went to music school in the U.S., and so my musical vocabulary is in English mainly. I remember finding it difficult to communicate with them because I would throw all these words in English. You know, I was also very nervous because we didn't have time to rehearse, you know, because I had just arrived to Mexico. And so just one rehearsal, that's what was going to happen, you know.
Leaving the rehearsal hall that day, Diana couldn't help but marvel at how much had changed in the years that she was away.
I think I was about their age when I left, you know, when I left in search for a music program and, you know, I immigrated to the United States. And when I left, none of this existed. That big theater, we didn't have, you know, places where...
The murder rate in Juarez peaked exactly a decade ago, in 2010, and then began to fall. Businesses have reopened, nightlife has returned, and so this is the Juarez that Diana is returning to. It's not the Juarez of her childhood, but it's also not the Juarez that she heard about on the news for all those years.
You know, it's sort of like I'm seeing the place after the storm has passed. Before each performance, I usually take a few minutes to reflect and to have it sink in. You know, when I first arrived in Mexico, I was receiving. Everything was receiving. But then when I got to perform, I was finally giving them a piece of me, telling them through music, I am here. This is me. Oh, Juarez, querido, mi México hermoso. Of course, I sang in Juarez, and to me, you know, singing that song for my people is like saying to them, you know, I'm sorry I wasn't here for all this, but here I am now, and I thought of you this whole time. You have been on my mind, and I want to make up for it, and hopefully this song will serve as an offering.
Mexican singer Diana Gameros speaking there with Ethiopian-American singer Meklit Hedero. Their conversation is part of a music special we brought you earlier this year, featuring immigrant musicians with roots in Sudan, Syria, Ethiopia, and Mexico. Those musicians all grapple with a common question: where and what is home? You can find the entire hour-long music special, a playlist, and videos from the artists at theworld.org. Climate change is expensive. Over the past 5 years in the U.S., weather disasters fueled by climate change have cost more than $500 billion in damages. And that's just in the U.S. Richer countries have agreed to help out developing countries by ponying up funds to help them deal with the impacts of climate change. But with the key funding deadline, 2020, drawing to a close, many say they're not doing enough. The World's Carolyn Beeler reports.
This is just the beginning of the South Pacific storm season, and Cyclone Yasa ensured it was a destructive start.
When Yasa hit Fiji as a Category 4 tropical storm 2 weeks ago, it killed several people and forced tens of thousands to evacuate.
Houses and other buildings were destroyed and crops flattened.
Speaking to Al Jazeera, Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama gave a simple explanation for the frequent storms that are ravaging Fiji.
The world is getting warmer. These storms are getting stronger.
In this video, the trees behind the Prime Minister are whipping wildly in the wind.
Every one of us must treat these climate-fueled catastrophes with deadly seriousness.
Fiji is one of the Pacific islands that's most at risk from climate change. Diplomat Satyendra Prasad says the government has a long-term plan to try to prevent the kind of damage that Cyclone Yasa brought.
We are relocating the villages which are on the front line. We have identified 40 villages which are very coastal.
But moving an entire village is complicated for a lot of reasons. And it's expensive, says Prasad. He's Fiji's ambassador to the UN.
We don't have the money for them. We've finished five others at different stages. And as resources become available, we are relocating these villages to higher ground.
If Fiji wants to make itself climate resilient, it would cost close to $5 billion over the next decade. That's according to an estimate from the World Bank.
This is way, way beyond us.
And here's one of the big challenges with climate change. People in rich countries have historically done the most to cause it, but people in poor countries will feel its impacts the worst. And they already are.
It is certainly a matter of equity, and it is a matter of justice.
Jeanine Felsen is the UN ambassador from Belize. She says money to help developing countries deal with climate change has been an important part of international climate negotiations for decades.
Social, economic, or you could call it climate justice, it is really the underlying rationale for adaptation finance.
Adaptation finance is money to help developing countries deal with the impacts of climate change. It's usually mentioned in the same breath as another type of finance for mitigation. That's to help countries cut their greenhouse gas emissions. In 2009, developed countries pledged $100 billion a year for those two categories by 2020. That comes from grants and loans from governments and the private sector. Fiji's ambassador Prasad says that kind of money would help Fiji adapt faster.
And if we are adapting faster, then each time a catastrophe strikes us, we will not be falling further behind.
We don't have figures for 2020 yet, but a report from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development found that in 2018, developed countries were still short of that $100 billion target by more than $20 billion. The funding has been growing over the years, but Wanjiri Mathai from the World Resources Institute says even still,
it's just not happening fast enough.
This is most true, she says, for the adaptation piece of the pie. That's the money to help countries deal with things like droughts and storms made worse by climate change.
We know that adaptation action lags even further behind.
According to that OECD report, adaptation funding adds up to only about a fifth of overall climate financing. And that is despite a promise written into the Paris Climate Agreement pledging a balance in mitigation and adaptation money.
It is shockingly low. These are real signals. Actions speak much louder than words. These are the signals of the prominence and visibility that we are giving to adaptation. Not that great.
Jesse Young from Oxfam America explains that projects to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions are easier to fund.
It is easier to finance things that generate cash. If you build a solar array, you build a wind farm, it generates revenue. You can securitize that. You can sell a bond based on it because there's a revenue stream.
Adaptation, on the other hand, doesn't usually turn a profit for investors.
If you are elevating a community so they don't flood, or elevating a generator station, or building a seawall, or helping a farming community adapt to saltwater intrusion into their lands, that doesn't always generate money.
The UN Secretary General has repeatedly called for more adaptation funding in recent months, and there are a few signs that it might come in 2021.
Ich setze mich dafür ein, dass wir international einen Prozess.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel said earlier this month she's working to launch a new phase of international climate financing, and the United Kingdom appointed a representative to rally adaptation funding ahead of the UN climate summit it's hosting next year. Oxfam's Jesse Young says in a roundabout way, the pandemic may help change the way leaders think about international finance for climate change in the future.
As we hopefully start to vaccinate a good chunk of the world, I think our posture towards threatening global phenomenon and what government are willing to spend on them may change somewhat in the wake of COVID.
What's not clear is whether that posture change can outweigh the financial hit caused by the pandemic and get developed countries to reach deeper into their pockets to deal with climate change in 2021. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
If you've ever driven down a gravel road and a chunk of rock has ruined your windshield, you may be able to imagine just how dangerous it's getting in space. Space junk is a growing problem. Thousands of defunct satellites are orbiting Earth at dangerous speeds, sometimes shedding debris. Josh Willis is a NASA scientist who works with satellites.
As people probably realize, space is getting cluttered around the Earth, and we have to start being responsible and throwing away our trash.
Now, recent regulations require all defunct satellites to be brought back into Earth's atmosphere when their mission is over to burn up. But when they do, they release thousands of tiny particles that themselves can be dangerous. Now there's an idea from Japan for a solution. Kyoto University has teamed up with a Japanese forestry company to build satellites out of wood. The idea is that when they burn, they won't release the harmful aluminum particles that a traditional satellite would. One of the people spearheading this project is astronaut and Kyoto University professor Takao Doi. On a 2008 mission to the International Space Station, he brought a key piece of equipment from Japan.
And the one
side of five. It's a small step for one Japanese astronaut, but a giant entrance for Japan to a greater and newer space program.
Professor Doi told the BBC that wooden models would help mitigate the negative environmental impact of satellites. The next step? The forestry company Doi is teaming up with told the BBC that it would work on developing wooden materials suited for space, resistant to temperature changes and sunlight. Then, Doi says, they'll model the wooden satellite and begin manufacturing. They plan to launch in 2023. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Marco Wurmeren will be back with you tomorrow.
From PRX.